Gonna have to get used to this echo effect. It's kind of different. So I think everybody knows me. My name is Andrew Brammer. I guess just before we get started a little bit, I'd like to kind of, I guess, give you some of my thoughts behind why I want to study this and kind of what it is we're going to be looking at. First and foremost, I do believe that the Bible is most fundamentally, it is a story that goes from Genesis to Revelation. It tells us a story of how God dwells with his people, how God interacts with his people, how God redeems his people. And there are a whole lot of run through the scriptures that show us that. And so what I'm hoping to do here is to pick one of those threads, and let's just kind of try to follow it through the scriptures as best we can. The one that I'm going to be focusing on is kind of the theme of the temple. And so as we look through, or as we go through this, please just keep in mind that we're, you know, some of the stuff, it's not that necessarily the passages that we're going to deal with don't deal with other things as well. But specifically, we're going to be focusing in on what they have to say about the temple and about how God dwells with us. And, yeah. So, and I think one of the things that this does show us is something about the nature of who God is, in that I don't think you can read through this and look at this topic in particular and not understand that the God who started this at the beginning already knew the end. So I'd like to start out with a couple of verses of scripture, if y'all don't mind helping me out reading. So if you would, Genesis 1, verses 24 to 31. Would somebody like to read that? Genesis 1, 24 to 31. Sure.
Then God said, let the earth bring forth living creatures, gather them together. God made the earth their ground, cattle and earth, everything that is on the ground. Then God said, let us remain in our image, our likeness of the temple or position to be the first time. So all the earth. God created man in his own image. God created him. Male and female created him. God blessed them. Then God said, they have given them all the earth. Yes, food. Earth, sky, everything here. And life. Green food. All that can be.
Thank you. So, I guess let's go ahead and read all the scripture, and then we'll go back and talk about kind of how they interact. So the next one is Genesis 2, verses 20 to 25. Somebody else want to read that? Sure, Mary. To 25. Yep.
Therefore, man shall leave his father and will rest with
Okay, thank you. And the last one that we're going to read here before we get started is Revelation 21, verses 1 through 8. Anybody else like to read that one? Sure, Anita. That's probably good. Thanks, Anita. So as we're looking through these passages, I guess one of the first things I want us to look at is what's the scope? So in each of these passages, how far do these extend? You know, is this a local thing? So in the Genesis 1 passage, are we talking about the Garden of Eden? And that's all? In the last passage, are we talking about the New Jerusalem as some, you know, like Toledo? Or is it broader than that? Yeah, so in the Genesis 1 passage, and maybe it would be helpful to back up and let's go through some of the individual passages here just a little bit. So Genesis 1, 24 to 31. What do we see here? Well, verse 24, and God said, let the earth bring forth living creatures according to their kinds. And we keep going down. Man's made in the image of God. In part, what does that mean? Well, at least in this passage, one of the things that we see when we look at like verse 27, I think your translation doesn't, the NASB doesn't have the little causal link there, but at least in the ESV, there's a word so before we get to God created man in his own image. And the importance of the so is that it ties it back to this passage that we've just read. So God created man in his own image. What is the so? Well, it's telling us that God made us in his image by, let them have dominion over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the heavens and over the livestock and over all the earth and over every creeping thing that creeps on the earth. And so... At one level, God is a ruler, right? God is the sovereign ruler over all creation and all the heavens and the earth and everything else. And so, in one sense, we're made in the image of God means that we also have some form of dominion, some form of rule over the created order that God has given us. I'm getting a little off topic here. So, I guess the first thing that I want to kind of highlight is that the sweep is global. It's not just the creatures in the Garden of Eden, but it goes beyond that to the whole earth. And then. So if we look at Revelation 21, particularly verse 1, then I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth had passed away, and the sea was no more. And so again, we get this picture of an entire earth. It's not localized in the way that the old Jerusalem was. The new Jerusalem comes down, but the God's picture, in part at least, starts with this tiny seed that is small and in the center of the Garden of Eden, but it was never intended to stay there. It was always intended to go out. That's part of the be fruitful and multiply, the God's commission. I'm blanking on the word here. Doesn't matter. So God commands the people to be fruitful and to multiply and to exercise dominion over all of the earth. And so Genesis, even in Genesis 1 and 2, we already see that things are intended to expand. But what do we see in Genesis 1 and 2, particularly with God dealing with man, that we don't see as we move forward from Genesis 3 to Revelation 20? Sure. So if we look at Genesis 1 and 2, and we look at how God deals with Adam and Eve in Genesis 1 and 2, that there's something in particular that we don't really see from there moving forward. What changes? Okay. What specifically changes in the fall, though? Okay. Yes. So the relationship that God has with Adam and Eve changes. The relationship that God has with humanity changes. But what changes about it? It goes from good to bad. It goes from perfection to... You get the introduction of sin and suffering and death and all of this. But... So in the beginning, God creates the world, and he creates this little seed, if you will, this little nucleus of what things are intended to be. And he's dwelling there with Adam and Eve. And he's dwelling with them in the way that he intended in creation. And then you have the fall. And now you have the entrance of sin and of death. And so I'm arguing in part that the rest of the Bible then, in part, is the story of how God is restoring that broken relationship. And so when we get then to Revelation 21 and we see the new heaven and the new earth and the new Jerusalem where God dwells with his people, and actually that's probably why I had more than just verse 4 in that. You get lines like, "Behold, the dwelling place of God is with man, and he will dwell with them, and they will be his people, and God himself will be with them as their God." But where else in Scripture do we see those kinds of or that kind of language? Yeah, and we also see it in some places, at least with regard to. Yeah. Yeah. Very much so. And so one of the things that we find is that you have this temple that is the mediating place. It's the place where God dwells with his people, right? And so everywhere that we find the temple coming up in Scripture, so with the tabernacle in Exodus and Leviticus, I believe we do get it with the Solomonic temple. I can't remember the reference on that one. But you get this reference of, and I will dwell, or God says, I will dwell with my people, and they will, or I will be their God, and they will be my people. So one of the questions that we have to deal with is, what is the significance of a new heaven and a new earth? So why is that needed? Why do we need something wholly new and not just renovated or not just tweaked? Okay. Okay. Why not? You're on the right track. Yeah. Because God can't dwell with sin. Because God cannot dwell with sin. And so something has to be done with this sin. And yet, this sin is so all-encompassing. It's so much a part of us that nothing less than a recreation will do. I think probably the best telling of this, I should have written this down on my sheet, but I believe it is Genesis. Oh boy. Genesis 6. Yeah. Yeah. Okay, thank you. And the Lord saw that the wickedness of man was great in the earth, and that every intention of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually. And so, if we're talking about the storyline, we have God who creates the world, and then we have people who rebel against God, right? And people rebel against God, and God judges them. They rebel, and they rebel, and they rebel, and God eventually judges them. And he judges them through the flood, where every living thing other than this little remnant is saved. And yet, even within this little remnant, that there's still this bit of sin that isn't wiped out. There's still something there where you can't go back to Genesis 1 and 2. Because the thoughts of man's heart are only evil continually. And so then, we know that anything less than total recreation simply won't do. Yep. So let's look at the fall. Yeah, it's probably a place. Oh, Earl. Yeah, I mean, I think there's a couple of things. One, at least, is when we talk about the fall, we tend to think about the fall of man because that's what God gives us the most information about. And yet, at the same time, there was the fall that happened before that, and that one happened in heaven. And if it hadn't, then you don't have the serpent in Genesis 3. Yep. Ezekiel. But also, again, just because you have the serpent in Genesis 3, that there is some heavenly being, if you will, that is not... that seems to be in rebellion against God, that seems to be at odds with God's creative purpose. He contradicts God directly. So, is that happening right now? Well, no, I don't. It wasn't before. Certainly, it wasn't before creation in the sense, like before God created the heavens and the earth. We're not given a whole host of information about that fall from the heavens, other than to know that that's why there are angels and powers and principalities that are at odds against us, that Paul refers to, the devil. And you look at like Revelation 20 is another one where it talks about the devil, or sorry, Revelation 14, where it talks about Revelation 12, where it talks about the great red dragon, that ancient serpent. That starting in verse 7, now arose war in heaven, like when his angels fighting against the dragon, and the dragon and his angels fought back, but he was defeated, and there was no longer any place for them in heaven. And the great dragon was thrown down, that ancient serpent who is called the devil and Satan, the deceiver of the whole world. He was thrown down to the earth. And his angels were thrown down with him. And so even there, you could skip down a couple of verses and you see... Now the salvation and the power of and the kingdom of our God and the authority of his Christ have come. For the accuser of our brothers has been thrown down, who accuses them day and night before our God. And they have conquered him by the blood of the Lamb and by the word of their testimony, for they love not their lives even unto death. Therefore rejoice, O heavens, and you who dwell in them. But woe to you, O earth and sea, for the devil has come down to you in great wrath, because he knows that his time is short. And so you have... at least in some sense, according to Revelation 12, these heavenly powers that have rebelled against God and yet have lost in that realm, and so they've been cast down here and are, in some sense at least, coming after us, coming after the church, coming after Christians and believers. And the accuser of the brothers. Yep. Yeah. Yeah, and there's more we can mine out of Revelation 12 as well. I'm just trying not to turn this into a Revelation class. So actually, if we go back and we look at Genesis 3, would somebody like to read kind of Genesis 3, 1 to 13? Let's try talking about that before we get into the curses. One through 13. Yep. Okay. So, as we look through the passage, what is the temptation? Sure. Okay. Why? To be like God. Sure. Yeah, I at least am convinced that what's in view there, because certainly they know that God has told them not to eat this fruit, so they know that eating that fruit is wrong. It's evil. So I don't think the distinction there is knowing in the sense of, I know this is good and that's bad. It's knowing in the sense of deciding this is good and that's not. Which puts them in the place of God. So the temptation then is to be like God. But do you remember in Genesis 1:27 and 28 where we get the talk about being made in the image of God? So they're already, God has already made them as much like himself as a finite human creature can be. Yeah, shame enters. Yep. I believe so.
It is your first day.
It is my first day. Oh boy. So we'll wade right into controversy here.
It's a trap.
It is. Okay. So in Genesis 1 and 2, We see that God creates man, he creates woman from man, and he creates He gives dominion over all of creation to humanity. So we kind of wind up with this hierarchy, just as far as the way that the scriptures themselves kind of lay this story out. So you have man who is supposed to lead the woman, who is supposed, and together they're supposed to exercise dominion over creation. And then in Genesis 3, you wind up completely inverting that, where you have the created order, the serpent, the beast, tempting the woman who tempts the man, and at no point does God's established order take precedence. At no point does anyone in there exercise the dominion that God has given them. So the beast tempts the woman, who succumbs to the temptation. The man then is tempted by the woman, who, and he also succumbs to the temptation, as opposed to any of them standing up for what God has created and the safeguards that God has put in place. Does that make sense? Yep. Oh, yes, absolutely. Well, and then you get to the end, and yeah. And I think, too, don't miss the bit where the man blames the woman whom God gave him. So, why did you eat the fruit? Well, it's your fault, ultimately. Yeah. If you look at God giving dominion to man, who is supposed to be ruling over the creation, and then you invert that. Now you've got the creation ruling over man because man succumbs to the temptation, whether it's going along with it or actually being deceived. Man is being ruled by the creation, and then man is blaming God for it. Yeah. So I think just as far as flow of the narrative, that's the way it goes. So what is the sin that we see in the garden story? Yep. Okay. So what is, okay, not trusting God, disobeying God. I don't know how to ask a question to dig this one out. Yep. Yeah. Well, and even beyond that, because in not trusting God, one of the most fundamental things that makes sin sin is that something is occupying the place of God. Yep. Yeah, and at the well, they're on the so in the fall you get the dominion, you've kind of inverted the dominion mandate, right? And so now you've got man who has already succumbed to temptation. They've already, the curse is already a part of them. The sin is already a part of who they are. They've already decided to rebel. And it changed something deep within us, where our whole nature is perverse. We don't want to do the things of God. We don't want the things of God. We're not interested. As a matter of fact, in our natural selves, we're at enmity with God. We actually want to oppose Him. It's not even that we're neutral. And so you wind up, yeah, with this core claim that I will be God, that's at the root of the decision to participate in any sin. Yep. In the center. Well, and at the same time, he has the intention for them to enjoy the beauty of. And so, I guess I'm arguing in part, just so we got to get back to the mainstream here. Yep. the fundamental sin behind any sin is idolatry. It's this declaration that I will be God. And just to give you some scriptural backing for that, if you would turn to Colossians 3, verse 5. This is one of those list passages that everybody loves so much. But he says, put to death. Well, I'll give you a second to turn. Always heard that was Baptist air conditioning. All the pages ruffling. Okay. Put to death, therefore, what is earthly in you: sexual immorality, impurity, passion, evil desire, and covetousness, which is idolatry. And so all of these sins are wrapped up, subsumed in Paul's mind in idolatry. So this isn't just something I'm pulling out of thin air. So if we go back to the Genesis 3 bit, and if someone would read 14, let's do the serpent first. So we'll do 14 and 15. Meredith? Thank you. So one of the things, and I think everybody here probably is aware of this already, one of the things to not miss is 3:15, where we get the promise of restoration. So there is no going back, and yet one day things will be made new. Particularly in the enmity between the woman's seed, the seed of the woman, and the seed of the serpent, the seed of the woman who will crush the head of the serpent. And that's pretty much time, so I'll stop there. Thank you for your attention.